Well, hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of Kidney Compass Navigating Clinical Trials. My name is Brendan Nguyen. I'm a nephrologist at the George Institute for Global Health, and I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host, Shikha Wadhwani, and a special guest today, Professor Jonathan Barrett, who's going to be talking to us about new IgA therapies and some of the latest results that he's presenting at ASN Kidney Week in San Diego today. Perhaps I might start by handing over to my co-host, Shikha, who will introduce the topic and have a chat to Jonathan about it.
Yeah, thank you, Brendan. So we're very excited to be here at ASN Kidney Week. And as you know, this is a time of, I've heard people call it the renal renaissance, especially in the glomerular disease space, and specifically in IgA nephropathy. There's more excitement, I think, around IgA nephropathy than there ever has been. And Professor Jonathan Barrett certainly needs no introduction, but he is here today to talk to us about a very exciting late-breaking clinical trial and a molecule that, you know, some of you may have heard of, may not have heard of. So we'll go ahead and let him introduce himself and tell us a little bit about this new molecule.
Thanks, Shikha. Yeah, so I'm John Barrett. I'm a nephrologist from the UK, very interested in glomerular disease, particularly IgA nephropathy. And I think you hit the nail on the head. Things have changed amazingly over the last 2 to 3 years in terms of new drugs becoming available, interest in clinical trials, the fact we are recruiting patients to clinical trials in an unprecedented way globally. And we're answering some of the really key important questions in IgA nephropathy. And one of the drugs that we're investigating, which looks incredibly exciting, is a drug called atacicept. And this is a drug that blocks two very key cytokines that drive B cell and plasma cell proliferation and production of immunoglobulin. And those cytokines are BAFF and APRIL. And we know that in IgA nephropathy, those levels of cytokines are elevated in patients with the disease. We also know from the genome-wide association studies that there are genetic risk alleles associated with the genes for APRIL and for the receptors to BAFF and APRIL, in particular TACI. And atacicept is actually a version of the TACI receptor fused to a human IgG Fc portion and is therefore capable of binding both BAFF and APRIL and stopping them from signaling to B cells. And the rationale behind the approach is that we switch off the production of pathogenic IgA, which in turn stops immune complex formation, which in turn will then stop immune complexes depositing in the glomeruli and triggering the inflammation that we see when we look at kidney biopsies. And we know it's the inflammation that eventually leads to kidney scarring and kidney failure. So there's a very clear biological rationale behind this drug. And we've had some early data from a very small phase two that looked interesting. And we have the phase two data, the second phase two study, the Origin study that we're going to will present the 96-week data on. But we've already published some of the earlier data looking at the randomized phase of the study. So we published the initial 36-week data in Kidney International, and that compared three doses of atacicept to placebo. And the primary outcome was change in proteinuria. And there was a significant reduction in proteinuria with atacicept compared to placebo. We saw a significant reduction in Gd-IgA1, the pathogenic form of IgA. And over that initial 36-week period in those patients treated with atacicept, and in particular the 150 milligram dose, which is what's been evaluated in phase three, we saw no change in GFR. And this is in a group of IgA patients that are at high risk of progression. And we saw a loss of GFR in the placebo group. So that was clearly very exciting. And then all those patients in that initial randomized period were offered the opportunity for open label extension of atacicept at 150 milligrams weekly. And over 90% of those patients chose to have atacicept. And I'm presenting the 96-week data, which shows that in that high-risk population, the rate of loss of kidney function over this 2 year period was 0.6 mils per minute per year. So we're getting to the point of physiological aging of the kidneys. And so that's what's really exciting, in that we have a high risk population of patients who we would expect, based on the placebo arms of the phase three studies to over a two-year period to have lost between 10 and 12 mils of GFR. And what we're seeing over the course of 96 weeks of exposure to atacicept is essentially kidney function loss that is what we would see in the normal population. So 0.6 mils per minute per year. So something that I never thought we would see in terms of rates of loss of kidney function in a disease we know in most patients previous to these trials led to a relentless loss of kidney function and kidney failure.
I mean, it's quite remarkable, Jonathan, those results in the open label period, albeit there's no comparator arm. So there are caveats to this, and we look forward to the phase three data. But that rate of GFR loss is different to what we've seen in even other IgA trials in the active therapy arm. DAPA-CKD, not an IgA-specific trial, but RAP, loss of kidney function, several mils per minute, even with dapagliflozin, some of the other IgA testing as well, rapid loss of kidney function, even with corticosteroid treatment. So that 0.6 mils per minute per year is a really remarkable result. What are your thoughts on that treatment period? That 96-week treatment period is approaching the kind of two-year slope endpoint that is being used in phase three trials. Do you think that is a sign of what we might see in a phase three study with this particular molecule?
Yeah, I've got no reason to not think that that's what we'll see. I think you bring up SGLT2 inhibitors, and their treatments of CKD, they don't treat, we've got to be really clear here, they don't treat glomerular disease, they treat the downstream consequences of established CKD. What we're seeing here is what you achieve if you actually go about treating the fundamental disease causing nephron loss. And I think that's a big difference. Steroids treat predominantly an anti-inflammatory effect, which is short-lived. The doses of steroids used, for instance, in the testing study, are doses that are incompatible with chronic maintenance therapy or even repeat dosing because of toxicity. What we're seeing in the phase two study is a reduction in the rate of loss of kidney function to physiological aging, and a drug that is very well tolerated, in fact, with safety signals that are what we might expect, but are nothing that would give any cause for concern in terms of using this in an IgA population.
Now, I think that I agree with you all. This is, I think, something that we just wouldn't have expected when we look at all the other IgA trials to date. Does it surprise you? You know, these were not necessarily incident patients. These were not patients that were just diagnosed with IgA nephropathy. And we've had these conversations in the past about, you know, like in the U.S., something like 50% of patients are already at stage three CKD. They already have, as you will say, you're only working with half their nephrons to begin with. Were you surprised to see this degree of proteinuria reduction, GFR stabilization, and the reduction in Gd-IgA1, and even, you know, the hematuria resolution, given the fact that a lot of these patients have had this disease for quite some time?
Yeah, you make a really good point. And I think the Gd-IgA1 unexpected, because that's how this drug works. What is interesting is the magnitude of proteinuria reduction you see with this approach is less than you achieved with a hemodynamically acting drug, yet the GFR protection is so much greater. And that's what happens when you treat the disease and you don't resort to CKD therapies. So when you can treat the primary reason for nephron loss, I think you can achieve a much greater impact. And you're right, this effect was achieved in people with various vintages of disease in terms of time from biopsy. No, we don't have biopsy data because this wasn't an incident population, but it does speak to the fact that at any stage that you're at with IgA nephropathy, that there's a potential for stabilization of kidney function. One of the very interesting things about the mechanism of action, which we need to explore, is we very much accept that this may well reduce immune complexes by reducing Gd-IgA1, but I think there's likely to be a direct effect on the kidney, because BAFF and APRIL are present in the kidney, TACI is expressed on kidney cells. We know there are B cells within the kidney tissue itself. And I think there may also be a direct impact on cells in the kidney. We know, in fact, that TACI is expressed on macrophages. So there could be also a direct anti-inflammatory effect. We need to investigate all of these things. But I think at the end of the day, the patient won't care. Because if the patient's got stable GFR, then they're very happy because they're as close to being on dialysis at the end of 96 weeks as they were at the beginning. And that's essentially what matters, isn't it, for us as nephrologists and for the patients.
And Jonathan, you touched on the safety point a little bit, but wanted maybe you could expand on that in terms of the safety profile of the drug. Were there any serious infections and hypogammaglobulinemia with the drug observed over the 96-week treatment period?
Yeah, there were no serious adverse events from infection leading to death. There were some infections, as you might expect in a population. There were reductions in overall immunoglobulin levels, but nothing that meant that there was significant cause for concern. And in fact, one of the interesting things we did, because we recruited during COVID, is actually, and this data has been presented at an earlier meeting, is we looked at vaccine responses to those people who just happened to have had a vaccine during that initial period of the trial. And we saw no difference in vaccine responses, which I think is really reassuring in a young population where this could be a chronic therapy. And we are going to need to make sure those patients are properly vaccinated. And that's very different to a depletion strategy. Where we give rituximab, we know there's no point vaccinating for at least 6 months.
Exactly.
So that gives us some added benefit in terms of modulating those B cells, targeting the pathogenic IgA in a way that still doesn't stop them developing appropriate antibody responses.
John, one of the things that, you know, I think we're getting accustomed to with phase three clinical trials and IgA nephropathy is this accelerated approval pathway. So in the parent studies, you know, you have the 36-week usually interim analysis, and that's usually the primary endpoint. But then the regulatory agencies are asking to look at long-term, usually two-year GFR. Could you talk to us a little bit about, you know, the open label extension and sort of what are the endpoints that we're looking at in an open label extension? And, you know, you've sort of alluded to looking at some of these exploratory endpoints that aren't validated yet, but I think really add to the story and our understanding of this drug. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about how did you go about choosing what you're going to be looking at the end of that open label?
Yeah, I mean, we've already discussed there's no placebo. So this is descriptive data. It's not comparing against a comparator group for obvious reasons. But it is an opportunity to look at long-term safety primarily in this group and also to look at clinical effectiveness. So one thing we don't know is we may suppress proteinuria over 36 weeks, but over time, do we lose that effect? So are we seeing a sustained reduction in proteinuria? Again, the same for immunoglobulins, the same for Gd-IgA1. And we now have important GFR data. And I think these data are going to be incredibly useful in terms of thinking what that two-year eGFR data might look like in a randomized controlled clinical trial. But you can never say never. I would be very surprised if it looks any different, to be quite honest. But that's why we're doing the phase three study. This was never designed for the FDA to get registration for the drug. This was designed to generate important information that helps us understand how this drug works, safety of the drug, and provides an opportunity with the samples that are being collected to look at interesting biomarkers, not just Gd-IgA1, but potentially other biomarkers that might help us understand where this drug is acting and what we might want to look at in a phase three. You know, we're going to have a mass of biorepository samples in the phase three. It would be nice to test out some of our hypotheses on those phase two samples to see where we invest time and effort in phase three.
So, Jonathan, maybe finally you can tell us a little bit about the program development for atacicept and what's planned for the phase three study where possible. It's a 2-year slope trial, as many of the other IgA trials is it?
So it's a 36-week proteinuria readout. The trial has already recruited the patients that are required to generate that proteinuria data, so it's very exciting. Because we know we're going to see that data in about 9 months' time. So we're going to see it in 2025 at some point. And then, of course, we'll need to wait for the GFR data, and that will be on the total cohort. The great news for this program is that actually the way the drug is delivered, which is administered by the patient in their own home with an auto-injector, is actually the way it's going to be delivered in clinical practice. So we're getting lots of valuable information about the appropriateness or patient-administered drug. You know, will they take it? Mm-hmm. Do they take it? Do they know how to take it properly? And is it a pain for them? Is it going to be a disincentive for them to take this as part of standard care treatment? And actually what we've seen in the open label extension is I can't remember the precise number, but over 90% of patients that started the open label extension completed it for course of treatment. So we're seeing the acceptability of this approach because at the moment, the approved therapies for IgA nephropathy are all therapies. So this is going to be a change. We need to know that that's something our patients will take on board.
And Jonathan, the frequency of the administration?
So it's a weekly injection.
Weekly.
Yeah. And again, that's, you know, are our patients going to be prepared to commit to that? And the open label extension over 96 weeks clearly shows that actually the number of patients completing, the acceptability of that is completely fine with the patients that we're looking at.
And I know, you know, Jonathan, one of the things we talk about with these phase three trials is as we have more approved therapies, at least available here in the United States, conducting a placebo-controlled, you know, phase three trial comes with challenges. But having that open label extension added on, do you feel like that's a, you know, a big incentive for patients to kind of stick it out and stay in the trial? They know they're going to get drug long term as they're entering into a 2-year commitment and then, you know, beyond.
I absolutely do. I think it's going to get more and more challenging to deliver a placebo-controlled trial, particularly in the United States. And we are having to look at how we redesign IgA trials with all of these new therapies. I think credit to the sponsor of this trial, they have committed to supply the drug to all trial participants wherever they are in the world until that drug is available and approved in that country. So there's not a 1-year open label extension and then that stops. It is there as an open-ended agreement with the patient that they will have access to the drug as long as they need it. So I think that's a real credit, because what I've been hearing from countries in South America and Southeast Asia is, why am I doing all this effort to get my patients into a trial of a drug that is ultimately going to be too expensive, inaccessible to my patients in my country, and the company may not even go about getting the drug approved? And we need to accept the IgA nephropathy community is a global community, and the vast majority of patients are being recruited from the companies that are not on the top 10 list of where drugs may well be marketed and approved. So I think it's a real commitment from the sponsor to say, if you commit to our trial, we commit to give you access to the drug for as long as you need it in terms of when that drug is finally going to get approved in that country. So I think that's what investigators and patients have really wanted to hear.
Well, congratulations again, Jonathan, on these really fantastic and promising results and the great publication in JASN and your presentation today. And we really look forward to seeing the phase three data. It's a fantastic time to be in IgA nephropathy, isn't it? And great for patients and great for clinicians.
Yeah, and you're not going to have to wait too long. So we should meet sometime middle of next year, because it will be exciting times.
Fantastic.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, everyone. That's our latest episode of Kidney Compass, where we discuss the latest in nephrology clinical trials, from therapeutic advances to new methodologies and statistical approaches. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and we look forward to you joining us next time for our next episode of the podcast.